So here we are, I'm in Sheffield today. I'm like roving around the world, you know, Krakow in one day, Sheffield the next day. And I'm talking here with John Barton, who in a way is my my boss. Are you my boss?
I thought you were going to say hero.
Hero, boss. So how would you, if when you're going through customs in America, what do you say your job is?
Publisher,
yeah.
And then they think I'm sort of in newspapers and a journalist.
Yeah.
And I was like book publisher. And then you just get that same, wherever you say it, you just get that thing. Oh, do people still read books all the time? It's like, do people still read books? Did not Kindle. It must be really tough. That's what we get. I'm grinning at you like I'm on the telly.
People feel sorry.
Yeah.
Remember that Bill Hicks thing where he's in a Waffle House and he's like reading a book and the waitress comes up and she goes like, what are you reading for? And he goes, so I don't work in a Waffle House.
Yeah. I'm not that clever. I just say, oh no, books of the future.
Is it like when you're writing in a, if you're in a cafe and you're writing, someone always goes up and says, who do you know that J.K. Rowling wrote all their books in a cafe? Yeah. Like I do, because everyone tells me every time I sit down and write in a cafe. So,
yes.
But the thing is, I think it's kind of a risky business to be in publishing.
It's more fun than graphic design, which is where I started my career.
Yeah.
So I sort of fell into having a graphic design business, and it's pretty awful because I'm not a very good salesperson, and I don't recognise people. I have a weird eyesight problem, and I find it really hard to recognise people. So obviously in sales, you've got to be very gregarious and you've got to be very confident, and you've got to be able to recognise people. And of course, I'd be in a sales meeting, and it tended to be with people in the outdoor trade, and then I'd see somebody at the crag and then, oh, how's it going, John? And I'd like blank them and ignore them and come over as sort of arrogant and aloof and all this sort of thing. And then later on, I'd realise, oh, that was a person I was pitching to 2 days earlier and I wouldn't get the work. So we always got told what to do as a graphic design company, because if somebody climbed better than me, then they would clearly be a better designer than me as well. So you always get told by your clients how to do their brochures and, you know, all the rest of it. And it got to a point I found that pretty soul destroying. So, but because we had graphic designers, we had capacity to print stuff. So we ended up doing a book, because I went out and wrote a book. So we ended up publishing this book, and we just got to do what we wanted. And it was just so much more fun producing the book and selling something I was proud of. And then the book sold loads. So we just generally...
Is this November?
No, November was just like a weird thing before we even got really started in the graphic design. The book was just a Dark Peak mountain biking,
or all right.
Peak District mountain bike. So it was just a mountain bike guide.
Yeah.
And everybody loved it. And we sold like tens of thousands of copies, and we carry on selling loads. So we just, and it was just more satisfying, because I think the problem with the graphic design, as I've said this before, we made a lot of our money out of persuading people to produce more stuff. So it was like, we designed their letterhead or their logo, and then we'd print them some letterheads. And of course, the more letterheads they printed, the more markup we made on the print.
Yeah.
So you were just in a business about putting more stuff in the world. And it got to a stage where...
And plastic bags.
Bags with a logo on, and plastic, bloody plastic pens. You know, you could, oh, I'll have 2,000 plastic pens. Nobody needs 2,000 or 5,000 plastic pens. So I ended up just doing loads of stuff in the world. And I was a bit uncomfortable with it, but you had to do it to make money. So I stopped doing it, and I published books. And it's the financials aren't very startling in publishing. It's not something that people invest in. We actually got some investment a year ago, and... So the investor said, okay, well, when we signed the contracts and everything, the money transferred over, and we had this business plan ready to develop. And he was like, right, we must do a press release about this amazing thing. So I just wrote this press release saying, Sheffield publisher gets loads of money. And he was like, well, that's just rubbish, isn't it? Who's going to publish that? He says, you should be linking it like to the Waterstone story, and you should be linking it to you know, the trends in publishing and all the rest of it, and all this kind of stuff. I said, no. This is big news in publishing. Nobody ever invests in a publishing business. And he just went really quiet down the phone, because he thought it was like a sexy business he was investing in. But yeah, no, it is, to answer the question, it is, you know, it's not the sort of business you get into to make money, not, you know, to make proper amounts of money. It's a little bit of a lifestyle business, and you've got to be passionate about it. You know, it's not a sort of business that generates vast quantities of cash.
Is it? I guess you're playing like a long game. Like, I remember, like Ken Wilson, the famous Ken Wilson, who was probably Britain's best. Was he, what would you call him? He was like a great editor and a great
publisher.
Yeah, like a real dynamic force in publishing. And I remember, like, when he used to ring him up, someone gave me his telephone number, and he'd ring him up and he'd just go, "What?" You know, when he answered the phone, he'd be like, "Oh, hi. And he was just like a terrifying character. But he was very, I guess he didn't spend any time dilly-dallying. He kept straight to the point. But I remember him telling me about, if you write something, it's going to be there forever. You can't get it back once it's printed. So it's not like a website, you can go and, you know, change it. But so that was something I really thought about for a long time, like make it as good as you can and maybe a little bit better. But he also said about it's like a long game, like you've got these books, you might have them for, you might print 4,000 books, it might take you 15 years to sell them all. Where I think nowadays with the big publishers, they print a million books by Jordan and they want them all sold by the end of January, don't they? Then they just pull them all. Or,
I mean, the interesting thing in distribution for publishers is they typically work on a 12-month cycle. So a warehouse will store your books for a year, and then if they haven't sold, they'll start charging you quite hefty storage charges.
Yeah,
which is basically to persuade you to chuck your books away and put in a new bestseller.
Yeah,
and I think we tend to work on a longer cycle than that. We just negotiated our way out of those storage charges, and I think one thing we've tried to do is we have tried to just produce fewer, better books that people want to read and share and give to other people, and hopefully not give too many away, rather than just producing bestsellers that you're going to read and then chuck in the recycling.
Yeah. I guess I should point out that in the global outdoor publishing, you're one of the three biggest, you know, there's Mountaineers, there's you, there's AS, is it Varlag in Germany? Like, all the others are quite, like, the amount of books you're publishing, it's pretty impressive. The amount of awards you're winning as well, like Banff and Boardman Tasker and things, like you're kind of punching above your weight, really.
Yeah. I mean, I think we're operating in a fairly small niche, and we have good authors, good contacts, and we just have a really good production team.
Yeah,
and we just put a lot of effort in, and I think that buys you a little bit of access to awards and things. So
you're like boutique.
So I think I'd like to think, you know, we do tend to win one of the big mountaineering awards every year, touch wood. But I think we've reached the position now that our entries at least get read.
Yeah.
And when 30, 40, 50 books are getting submitted to an award, you can't expect the judges are really going to have to consider everyone. So I think we've carved out a bit of a name for ourselves. So it keeps us. But we've got some good books.
Yeah.
And I think we're trying to support. You know, mountaineering has a long tradition of publishing, and I think publishing really strong books. Not that many of them break out of the niche.
Yeah.
I think things like the Boardman Tasker Award has got to be careful that it stays as a mountaineering award. It advertises itself as a book about mountain, but I think it needs to sort of clarify itself a bit more going forward. And it, my personal opinion, it needs to be a mountaineering book award, because I think if it broadens itself out too much, it'll lose some of its. You know, if you think of some of the books that's won Boardman Tasker, like Savage Arena. Didn't win, obviously.
Yeah.
But Touching the Void,
yeah.
Painted Mountain, Psycho Vertical, Cold Wars, your two books, Deep Play, Paul Pritchard's book, you know, these have really, they've just been really core books, you know, from first-time authors, just been, you know, amazing books. And I think if it sort of broadens out too much, it'll lose some of that. And I think the genre can get, you know, it needs its own award. There's loads of travel awards and there's loads of those sort of awards. There's hundreds of them. And I think the board, you know.
Do you think it needs to be like quite edgy?
Yeah.
Like climbing literature. It needs to, because it does seem to me like climbing has become kind of a lot more like sort of conformist in a way. Like I think some of the characters, you know, like, well, Nick Bullock and people like that, they are kind of edgy kind of characters.
Yeah.
And they're kind of spiky characters. You don't want to be having too many, you know, literary kind of darlings writing these books.
I think absolutely. I think that's exactly.
Like almost, like McFarlane, people like that, I often feel like they're great writers, but they're almost like a tourist. They come into some area and then they'll just write this amazing book about it, but then they don't really, you know, like, you know, they have one day out on the hill and they'll write a whole book about this one experience where maybe the, you know, the more difficult kind of books, you know, I guess again, like Nick's or like Mick Fowler's, they're much more like a grassroots kind of view of mountaineering. They're not all flowery and full of poetry and things.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's it. And I think, you know, I'm a big fan of the Boardman Tasker Award, but I think it's interesting. The last two winners, you know, the publishers haven't bothered updating their title information to say the books won the Boardman Tasker Award.
Yeah.
Even the Boardman Tasker website's not bothered putting it on the winners. And I think, you know, I think for things like, you know, Beyond the Mountain or, you know, some of those winners, you know, in Cold Wars, and Ron Fawcett's book, it was just such a big thing to win that award.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, we've got to keep that sort of publishing edgy.
Because I guess you're also like creating, like the mountaineering culture is about films, it's about, you know, like YouTube videos, it's about books, it's about all these elements, like mountaineering itself or climbing itself is a very personal thing. And I think it'd be very easy just to have, you know, you see more and more guidebooks with no history in them. It's just a purely athletic, that's the line, go there. If you go to other places, like, you know, when you go to a Rapalies, you look at the current, like a Rapalies guidebook, it's just, you know, this book that's so full of love for the crag and the history, and it really, you know, it makes a great crag, like an absolutely amazing crag, where you go to other places and you just have this very, you know, there's no real knowledge of the place. Like North Face the Eiger, you didn't have the White Spider and all this film and literature about it. It would just be a big chossy crag, really. It wouldn't be anything to it. So I think that's interesting. Like, I know when Random House stopped doing sort of mountaineering literature, if you hadn't been around to sort of take up that, you know, where they left off, you wonder what would, you know, would it just all died on the vine? Because in that period, where people were trying to get books published and Random House weren't doing it anymore, and it seemed like you appeared just at the right time, really.
Yeah, I think we started off and we did some guidebooks, and then John Cofield joined us, and I sort of sat down with John and said, what I want to do is mountain literature. I want to produce, sound like a bit like a knob now, but I wanted to produce the kind of books I'd read when I was growing up. That, you know, as soon as I went climbing and I thought, like, this is for me, this is what I want to do with my life, I want to go climbing. And then I just devoured whatever media I could get, which was climbing books, you know, the Boardman Tasker books, Savage Arena and Shining Mountain, and The Hard Years and all that kind of stuff. And I said to John, I said, like, you know, this is what I want to do, you know, and I want to get the, you know, the company good enough to be worthy of producing these things. And it's like, what, you know, and I was very aware of what Ken Wilson had said about, once, you know, once you've written, it's done, you can't drag it back.
Yeah.
It's going to be there forever, and, you know, so But also I wanted to write the kind of, I wanted to produce sort of the books of the climbing I was doing. So, you know, that's why we, the first one we did was with Jerry Moffat's book. And that was a gift really, because Jerry just had those anecdotes and
yeah.
could spew them out. And, you know, and he worked with Niall Grimes, who was just an awesome writer. And we just got that, that combination. And I think that was very good because it, it just gave us the confidence because it was such a successful book and it was so well done. And I was so excited about it that it just gave us the confidence just to do loads and loads of books.
Yeah.
Like that.
It's interesting because in a way you're getting down all the stuff in the cracks of like history, like by getting people to write these books. Like I've been trying to interview my uncle, who was one of the first sort of salvage divers from like he lives in Hull. And I keep missing him. And I kind of know that like if he was to just disappear tomorrow, you know, all this information he had about diving on World War II submarines and all this kind of stuff, it would all just disappear. He's never written it down. So like getting like Ron and Jerry and everybody to write these books, like in the, you know, they're there forever really. People can go back and, yeah. you know, like read them.
It's quite amusing. I've got a friend who's, deputy editor at the Sunday Times, and he's had a lifelong career in journalism and generating stories and all the rest of it. And he often comments on some of our books and some of the stuff we do. And he said, you know, we're just so close to the stories, we don't realise how big the stories are.
Yeah.
And he you know, he's very clear that the, you know, there's a lot of personalities out there. Bear Grylls would be one of your favourites, who really do suck up the oxygen. You know, this sort of people have, you know, people have got only so much, they can only listen to so much stuff about outdoor adventure. And there's, you know, some big personalities out there who are sucking up all that oxygen and all that attention. And then, but we're so close to the climbing, the story, we don't realise how big those stories are. And it's only looking at how successful Jerry's book's been, Revelations, and the books that we did following on from that, which was like Ron's book and Andy Pollard's book, that period in history was incredible. You know, it went from people in, you know, bumblies in their tweed breeches, you know, having a laugh at the crag and climbing E1, you know, just became that amazing sport that that hasn't sort of moved on again.
No.
It was a revolution in sport, and you didn't. You know, you still don't realise how significant it was.
I guess it becomes normalised. Like if you're living in Chamonix, or you're living in Sheffield, or you're living in Boulder, Colorado, it becomes it just becomes a normal thing. You don't realise when we both sit and have a drink with Catherine Destivelle once or something. You know, but like Catherine Destivelle, you're sitting with this woman who must be. She's like 60 or something. She's, you know, she's well, anyway.
More words.
She's a more mature woman. But then you think like no one has ever really bested Catherine Destivelle in 30 years, like what she achieved in her time, in all these different disciplines and you know, high altitude, big walls, soloing, and but just you kind of. If it was anyone else, it'd be like meeting, you know, one of the, like Pelé or some, you know, incredible athlete. But you're just in this bar having a drink with this woman, you know, like it becomes maybe in the future people look back and it'd be like meeting, you know, like an astronaut or somebody. But it's we're very lucky in that we're in the sport is so the different. Like you can go to a slideshow or whatever, and you could be talking directly to. You know, Reinhold Messner or Conrad Anker or, you know, Alex Honnold, you can see him at the crag. So there isn't this kind of distance that if you're a footballer, if you're into football, the chances of being in a bar and Eric Cantona's there or whatever, they're kind of quite small. But in climbing, you can go to any crag and you can see Adam Ondra. You know, I think the only time he ever got a selfie with a famous climber was when I saw Adam Ondra and I had to pretend it was for my girlfriend. I was like, oh, I just need to get a photograph. And you do kind of get this... starstruck, but at the same time, like sometimes they're too human. You know, these famous people when you meet them, kind of a down at heel. But
I was in a cafe with the family and two or three other families on holiday, and my phone goes, and And obviously, my wife gives me a bit of a dirty look because it looks like I'm taking a work phone call, which is exactly what I was doing. So I got up from the table, had a 10-minute chat, sat down, and my wife was like, "Who was that?" I said, "Oh, it was Chris Bonington." And she's going, "What does he want?" But then we noticed on the table, there was the other three families were just like, "What?"
Yeah, yeah.
Chris Bonington's literally just phoned you up, Chris Bonington. Yeah. And I was like, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because I went to the Hay and Why Hay Book Festival, and Chris Bonington gave a talk there. So I went there with my wife and saw this talk. It was really amazing. Like, Chris Bonington is so good at crying, so good. Like, he's also good at almost crying, and everyone's like, but it doesn't make people feel uncomfortable when he does it. So afterwards, I just sent him an email. I was like, "Hi," I just found his email somewhere. I was like, "Hi, Chris. Just wanted to say, like, I thought it was really great and how it was different to all the other times I've seen him talk." And he just I'm like a mini celebrity, but he just replied straight back. But he just replied just like a climber would, yeah. And he's like, "Oh, that's nice. And listen to this," or whatever. And there isn't that real separation where if you met like Kim Kardashian, you know, yeah, and you tried to send her a message and said, "Oh, I'm a beast. C celebrity, you know,
I'm starting out my fashion business."
Yeah. So I think we're kind of very lucky because the people in some aspects of their life, they are really kind of extraordinary human beings, like what they've done, really. I think that's but maybe it's the more human ones where you, like, so Tony Howard or these, you know, the people you meet, there's very little room for pretentiousness and, you know, being there's a few, but not too many. But I guess the first time I ever read anything that you were involved in was The Thing.
Yeah.
So if anyone, I doubt anyone's ever seen it, but The Thing was like a tiny, like, A5, just for Sheffield climbing, like, little fanzine thing, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And you see, what was interesting about The Thing, it was very funny. If you lived in Sheffield, it probably wouldn't make any sense if you lived in anywhere else in the world.
No, I think it was
very Sheffield focused. But it reminded me, if you read the old, like, Craggs magazines, they just took the piss out of people all the time. Like, no one could ever, you know, they always take the piss out of Chris Bonington or, you know, Ron Fawcett. They were very they'd just be done for libel these days. Yeah. But they had no respect for anybody. That was, I guess, like, you know, nowadays you don't have that. You have a much more of a respectful, like, journalistic kind of thing. Do you think that's true? Although there aren't many magazines left anymore, is there? So.
Yeah, we have to, you know, when we're doing a book, you know, we have to read it and, like, take stuff out that we think is a bit edgy and all the rest of it. But when we did The Thing, we just didn't give a.
Yeah.
We didn't have any money.
It wasn't worth suing you.
We didn't have any money, and we were just and everybody. You know, I think I got punched once, but everybody, you know, you
were just horrible to everybody. So.
Yeah, we were just horrible to each other and to everybody, and the printing quality was just appalling. And,
yeah,
the jokes were really bad, and the whole thing was just a joke, and it was so amateurish. We would, you know, we sort of did issue one and issue two, issue three, and then we all went away climbing for a year, and then so we just plain old missed issue four, I think.
Yeah.
And then so then our issue four became this mad collector's item, but it never, I don't know which issue it was, but it literally never existed.
Yeah.
And then,
like, it's like issue zero of Alpinist. Is
yeah.
That, like, everyone wants one, but.
Yeah. So, but yeah, there was just so much, you know, it was just easy to take the piss out of people. So we just did.
Yeah. You think that climbing is really, would a really good sport to have these kind of fanzines, you know, like punk fanzines or football fanzines, because the summer we seem to have, like, all those, you know, magazines, like On the Edge and these kind of things. Even I used to work for High Magazine. I wouldn't say that was at the same, that was very different. The magazines are very different, weren't they? But On the Edge was really an interesting magazine. They had some really good stuff in there. They only paid, I think you used to get stamp money if you got something printed in there.
Yeah.
But you look back at it now, it created a lot of interesting, like, writing, and, like, Paul Pritchard and all these people sort of started there. Where now I can't remember last time I saw like a magazine in the UK. I think Climber, one of those ones.
I'm sure there is one.
Yeah, there's still somewhere.
UKC now. We just did the thing, and then I wrote the peak climbing note, peak scene for On the Edge, and I carried the humour through and the piss taking through.
Yeah.
To peak scene, and that's when I started getting into trouble.
Yeah.
Because people just thought I was being arrogant, but I was just taking the piss.
Yeah, yeah.
And I didn't even know. And there was like, I think it was like the hard grit was, so there was a lot of young kids who were climbing quite well, and they were like putting up routes and claiming grades for them, and I was just like, jokingly downgrading. And like, I think there was one route, and some E637, but it'd been done in the summer. So I just claimed it'd be hard VS come the winter, and everybody took it seriously.
Yeah. I probably came to Hickman when Richard Patterson gave the first ascent of, Bourgest.
The slab. Knocking on Heaven's Door.
No, the other one. No, the John Dunn, Johnny Does.
Oh, Parthian
Shot. Parthian Shot, and he'd give like Seb Greve like the first ascent or something. Yeah. And I think that was probably the final shot of that of those days, really. After that, everyone became a lot more sensible, because I think there's a lot more. I think now we have a lot more advertising, so if you can't really upset any sponsored athlete who the advertiser is putting adverts in the magazine and things, it's very it's a weird thing, really. Maybe that's what's good thing about podcasts. You can say what you want. So then, and then you did November, which was that sort of a first ever climbing comic type thing, graphic novel we call it now.
Graphic novel.
So there's no way you can get these things just like in the ether somewhere. You can't.
I think if you can get hold of a copy in November, we don't have any left. November is very good.
Yeah.
If you can find one. Sure,
it's a shame you can do like a PDF or some kind of Kindle-y thing, isn't it?
We sort of had the artwork and we had some copies left, and I nearly did reprint it or do something, but I thought, what's the point?
But it was very unusual, wasn't it? It was a very it was almost like, reminded me of what's that thing with Whistle Down? No, When the Wind Blows or something.
Yeah, it was totally.
It was kind of quite dark sort of comic thing.
Yeah.
There's always something cool when someone does something which is almost completely uncommercial. Like, it's like a lost leader, or you're not just coming in there with, 20 ways to get better at bouldering. You're doing, like, instead of doing that, you're doing this book, like a graphic novel about, it's kind of why spend all that time and effort just for the love of it.
Yeah.
And I think that's always kind of nice to see that kind of thing. But it's,
we won the I don't even know what it was. I think it was some mountain festival over in Wales, and Jim Perrin had organised it. We won the Mountain Literature Award.
All right.
This thing, and we had to trek over, and it was like, and then we got there, and it was like, oh yeah, sorry, there's no money or prize, but you have won. So I think that was the first prize we won.
It's interesting how people. You do things and you just go out into the ether and you just forget about them. And then you never really, you don't know what impact it has. I remember Simon Pantin in North Wales, who writes the guidebooks there. He had this thing called Northern Soul, which was literally a load of like photocopied sheets of paper. And not long ago I met someone who said, oh, you had this thing in Northern Soul. And it was like one of the best things I'd ever read. It was something that later went into Psycho Vertical. And I was just like, first of all, I can't remember what he's talking about. I was like, Northern Soul, like, what the hell's that? And he's like, oh, that thing, it was like loads of sheets of paper. So people could just pick these things up and they take them away, and they can have like an impact on people, like totally out of proportion to the, the quality of the thing itself. So, but I guess like so I always think about Vertebra as that they're the beginnings of it. Those, these kind of quirky, uncommercial kind of strange things, and I do feel that kind of bleeds a little bit into all the things you do, because there's always a very like graphic, because you do see a lot of publishers and they're always just getting by, they're just doing the least amount of possible, it's just not worth putting that amount of effort into something because it's the margins are so tiny in books, and just bang it out and it'll be okay. Do you know when you write a book, you spend so much time doing it, and then you get someone who takes the design as like, they just think, oh, we're just going to put, we haven't got room to put this picture here, we're just going to get rid of it, or yeah. And you're like, no, but that's it's part of it. And I always feel like you, Vertebrate, go the extra mile on all their books. Like every book is like the last book in a way.
So when you start a book, when you know you're working with an author, I'll tend to say, what do you, you know, when the book's published, what do you want out of it? What's going to make you happy? And they'll sort of say, I just want to share my story. I just want to give advice. I just want to see, I just want to give something back or something. Or they'll say something like, I would like to see a lot of photos in it, and all this kind of stuff. So you try and take that on board and you do it. And then, of course, a year after it's published, it's like, where are my royalties? How come it's not sold more? And it's like, you have to remind them about, well, I thought you were just trying to give something back. But we sometimes start a book thinking, right, well, it's probably not going to make us any money or the rest of it, and we'll just try and rush it out. But you just get sucked into the book and yeah. get sucked into the photos and the design, and you try and... It's quite interesting. One of my favourite books was Andy Pollard's Punk in the Gym. And it came to us. I knew Andy. I climbed with him out in Australia, and obviously he was just an utter rock god to me. And it came as handwritten chapters, just these handwritten stream of consciousness chapters, and I kind of loved them. And our idea was just literally to publish them like that,
right.
just to make this book exactly like Andy was sending, almost photocopy these handwritten chapters and put them into a book, and that would be the book. And we'd print 250 copies, and it would just, that's what it would be. And for some reason, it just ended up being the most expensive book we've ever produced. It's got more colour photos in, it's got more printing treatments, it's got illustrations in. We sourced every photo we could possibly get. All the chapters that came over went in. It went through three editors.
It's a beautiful book.
And it turned into a beautiful book, and Andy was really proud of it, and that's good. And then obviously Andy's gone now, but it's really, I'm really pleased we ended up doing that. It's a book I pick up and read passages from. It's a book I enjoy. That and Unknown Pleasures, but I'm not going to say that to you. but it is quite interesting. Every time I look at it, I always think, I wonder what it would have been like if we just bound those handwritten
chapters in
the book. And part of me thinks, I wonder whether that would have been more special.
We will
try and do that one day, but yeah.
It's amazing, Andy Pollitt, how he was a man, he had, I don't know if it's good timing, but the way he was so huge and then he just disappeared. He was like Kaiser Sose, where he just disappeared. And then he reappears and he writes this amazing book, and it's, and then he just goes again. It's amazing that we managed to get him to get, because he could have, if he just died and he hadn't written that book, all that stuff would just have gone.
But I think that was Andy. You don't get to pull out, you don't get to do some of those ascents by not having an ability to knuckle down and focus.
I think
part of his coming and going was to do with, his mental health issues and the drinking.
Yeah, yeah.
And the fags. And I think he just had really dark times.
Yeah.
But then he would come back and he needed that sort of attention.
Yeah.
The pink tights was all about, look at me.
But yeah, yeah.
It was worth looking at him because it was incredible.
I find that a lot recently. I think I was joking when I came here that everyone I've been interacting with recently, they all seem to have mental health issues. And I think one thing, if you're a creative person, you have to realise that that is one aspect of why you are creative, is you are so sensitive to everything. And that's the burden, is you're going to be a fucking screw up, manic depressive, because you're like, I always think about Superman. I think where Superman could hear every single person speaking at once. I think you do have that, if you're a bricklayer, you're probably not like that. You probably have better mental health because all you see is the bricks,
from the driving rain.
Yeah. But I think maybe if you're a creative person, you have to try and think more like a bricklayer and just turn it on and off, turn on your sensitivity every now and again.
It's we were having a laugh in the office because obviously our intern is closely related to you. And so you have this social media persona where you're making a lot of comments, and you know, some of them are interesting, some of them are less interesting, and some of them are quite edgy, and you're drawing a lot of attraction, and you would think you're very thick-skinned. And then we're talking to your son, and he's saying, no, quite the opposite. And then I was relating when you showed me the first bunch of chapters on the fiction book you're writing, Bear Pit.
Yeah.
And you asked me to comment. And my first thought was, well, your writing is so superb, and I'm, you know, although I'm a publisher, I don't feel as though I'm a literary critic. And, you know, and I'm a bit unsure of how to give constructive feedback, or you know, feedback to somebody. So I just said the first thing that came off the top of my head, and then I think you were quite upset about
no,
it.
No, you said there was too many, so much swearing or something, too many fucks or something.
That might be somebody else. No, I said it was too northern. I probably said,
oh no, too northern. Swearing. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. But it is, you know, it is.
I think that's why it's really important to, like, when I was at this film festival the other day. We were, I was staying in one hotel and everybody else in another hotel, and we'd just been somewhere, and then we're supposed to be meeting to go somewhere else, and then they just said the message, like, oh, sorry, we've gone without you. And for a second had this thing like, oh, they've gone without me because I just gotta spend the whole time talking and I like, dominate all the conversations and they just want to be free of me. And then you just have to grab that part of you and just say, like, squeeze it and, like, just get a grip. So because it's that sort of, it's that sensitive part of you. And I think maybe some of that being controversial or being a contrarian is trying to make yourself thicker skinned, if you know what I mean. But I don't know if it actually works. Like, maybe it's like the drinking more poison to make yourself, you know.
But people don't. I mean, if you publish or you do anything, you stick your head above the parapet and you'll get criticism. And,
yeah, yeah.
You know, we had some, you know, awful criticism, two awful bits of criticism about Andy Pollitt's book.
Yeah.
Recently, which I did find quite upsetting, because, you know, but you just got to sort of forget about it.
Yeah.
It's like, Jesus, Andy's dead. Just, you know, why are you dragging stuff up that you do, you know. So Andy, and you know, Andy, you know, because of his mental health, you know, often thought his book hadn't done as well as it should have done.
Yeah.
You know, but the bottom line is, what was going to make it successful? Look, the book is beautiful. It sold quite well. Nobody's made any money out of it. Andy made a bit of money. We're probably close to breaking even. The editor did all the work for nothing.
Yeah.
The photographers donated all the work to nothing. And then, you know, you get some idiot in the climbing scene who I won't name sort of saying, oh, Vertebrate really ripped Andy off. And it's like, you know, why would you say that?
I always tell people, remember that To Kill a Mockingbird has like 1-star reviews on Amazon.
Yeah.
So I think this thing that... For, 1% of people hate you, whatever you do, and 1% love you, whatever you do. So you just got the other 98% to fight for. But
I think the important thing I learned was you write the enraged email back to them and then put it in your drafts and then go climbing or go for a run and then delete it, and then it's and the world is
yeah so, yeah.
I mean, I remember when we were a graphic design company losing a huge contract, and I did take it personally because it was like a mate from the climbing scene. And we lost the work to somebody, and that was that. And I just went climbing on the way home and did some boulder problem, and I was like, oh, it really doesn't matter, does it?
Yeah. I think it's that ability to overcome those things. Like, I think you can take it personally, and you can spend 24 hours like going, I'm not going to do this ever again, I'm wasting my life. But as long as you always just come back onto an even keel and then you keep on going, that's all that matters. Yeah. Where some people, they are so... The physical, almost physical impact of that criticism, they can't face it ever again, you know, so they'll run off the stage, you know, when they're like, you know, 10, because these people laughed at them when they were on a pantomime or something, and they'll never go back on again. So it's that ability just to keep on, maybe it's, you know, if you have like an alpinist's mentality of just having a very short-term memory and just keep on going. And I always have this thing that before every great leap, there's a hurdle. And it's that ability to just think about that, because you often see people where they kind of fold. You know, they spent like 30 years trying to be a filmmaker or a writer or something they're actually really, really good at. And as they're doing it, they're getting better and better and better. But they don't see they're actually getting better. And also they see that they're getting less success, you know, people take them for granted. And it's that moment, I think, when they just stop doing it and they get a normal job or whatever. That was a time when there was probably something great was going to happen, because they're sort of beaten up and, you know, like they're much more humble, I think. You know, I think the more humble you become, you know, when you're young, we probably know people who are like young and super talented, and they're so big headed, and you know, they don't really appreciate their talent. But it's only when they're later on and they're all beaten up and feel over the hill that they start grabbing hold of the talent, because it's kind of all they realize what they had just before it slips away. Maybe if that makes any sense.
I think it's knowing. And it comes back to this mental health thing. It's knowing what success is, and it's, you know, I think it's knowing when you've done a good job,
yeah,
and not trying to think you're writing the best book the world's ever going to see, or it's going to be a multi-million-pound bestseller.
Yeah,
you know, it's if you're writing a book for the climbing scene, it's just trying to think what you're trying to do. Our motto is like inspiring adventure. We just want people to, you know, share the kind of things that I had when I sort of got into climbing and meeting famous climbers and going climbing with people and just discovering all these amazing places. And it's like for us with publishing, it's knowing, you know, it's knowing that we're successful. And,
yeah.
And successful, because if success is a number, there'll always be another number.
Yeah.
You know, it's like I do a lot of running. And there'll always be somebody faster.
Yeah.
So it's just knowing you've just gone out and had a good run.
Yeah.
You know, and you've raced really well, and you're the 12th person in your age category. Whatever. and just accepting that's brilliant.
Yeah. And it is a very long race writing, isn't it? Because you need. I think in the past there was they said you need about 10 books in print to make a living out of it.
Yeah.
And I think now there's just so much. Media out there, you know, like most people are going to watch YouTube rather than read a book, and you know, people listen to lots of podcasts, and you even like on you know, Twitter and social media. If you had a Twitter account like 10 years ago, there might only be you and a few other people, and then slowly there's just this like din of stuff. You know, the chance of someone watching a whole hour long video on YouTube of someone, Adam Ondra, they're probably going to be going off and doing something else, or on their phone, or doing so literature. So, but I guess that's why it's interesting you've gone into doing the audio books, because you know, people sit in, it's very hard to do anything when driving a car. So maybe that's
the future. Audio book. Well, I like audio books because I'm in the car a bit. But the interesting thing with audio books is I have a bit of a down on a lot of our books, because I tend to be the commissioning person. So I tend to read people's really rough, over long drafts of books, and then I make a decision whether we can publish them or not. So generally, that'll be the worst version of the book. That'll be, 100,000 words too long and really badly written in places, and then I'll commission it, and then I won't necessarily look at the book again, and then it goes through an editing process and it gets better and better and better in theory. We might make worse. And then I won't tend to read the book again. Sometimes I will pick up a book when it comes off the printers and I will read it, but I'll tend not to read it again. But then with audiobooks, I'm able to sort of plug one into the car and listen to it. And I'm, you know, arrogance aside, some of our books are awesome. And I'm just doing Mick Fowler's No Easy Way at the moment, and I'm just driving along laughing my head off at his
style
and what he's got to say about other climbers and things like that.
Who reads the books?
Mostly a voice actor.
Yeah.
So we have two or three people that we use that are quite reliable. We've only got about 20 audiobooks out.
Yeah.
Nick Bullock did his himself.
Yeah.
Takes about three times longer.
Yeah.
Because ironically, climbers, even Nick Bullock's not as good at talking as he thinks he is. but yeah, so mostly we use an actor.
Yeah. Definitely like a Northern, like a Nick Bullock type.
Yeah, we got like for Sandy Allen's, we had to find a Scot. Yeah. But the first Scot we found was too, because Sandy's quite down to earth.
Yeah.
And the first, we had this Scot, but he was over it, you know, it's like, we're going up the North Face. It's going to be really hard.
In a Scottish like a real accent. Thespian.
Yeah, like complete Scottish thespian. And of course, like Sandy's not like that at all. So then we had to find out, you know, we said, you're too Scottish. so we have to find people that can do accents and one thing and another. And then, of course, it doesn't sound like, you know, so when the author hears it, they hate it.
It doesn't sound
like them.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, Chris Bonington might make an appearance, and you know, the default is to have Chris Bonington as a really upper class accent, and that doesn't work at all. So yeah, we have all sorts of problems, and then we have pronunciation problems.
Yeah.
So I was listening to the Jerry Moffat's Revelations, and I was trying to work out who this guy Bashar was.
Yeah.
I met this great climber Bashar in America, and it was only when they were talking about the Bashar ladder that it clicked with John Backer. So, but then I just find that amusing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I was working. You know, Andy Cave was climbing with Simon Nadin.
Yeah.
All this kind of stuff. So that's kind of funny. It just shows how unprofessional we are.
You get some really good. Some really broad, you know, someone from Barnsley, like, it was really good. Yeah. You got it. Yeah. But the, I think one of the best audiobooks I've ever listened to if you're going to write climbing books, is that Alan Partridge one. What's it called? Where he's basically going walking. It's not called Stallion Heart, it's something like that. But it's one of the Alan, but Steve Coogan like does you know, yeah, is narrating it. But it's just, it really captures that, like, really bad writing so well. I think it's one of the best books on badly written, you know, where there's bits.
Was it you that sent me the clip from that where he's talking about
a logo. But it's just because, you know, people often like just over describe things. So I have this thing about people say, the cold white snow was falling from the sky, and you're like, well, I know it's white, I know it's cold, I know it falls from the sky.
One place for it to fall.
Yeah, we'll just say it's snowing, and but people have this thing, they really over describe everything. So what do you think? You're probably the number one person to, if someone's out there who wants to write a book or write something, what are the big mistakes that people make when they're submitting, you know, books to you?
God, the classic submission is to tell us all of other books are rubbish and this one isn't. That's the classic. you'd be surprised how much we get that.
Yeah.
And it's like, right.
Yeah. Straight in the bin.
Short of you, you know, being J.K. Rowling, they tend to go in the bin. In terms of submissions, I mean, if I'm honest, quite a lot of our books are commissioned, you know, or the, you know, the people we've known. But the raw stuff, you know, so it's stuff we're looking for. I mean, you know, we have been trying to publish some more books by women. We're looking for people that, you know, can write. Might sound silly. You know, we've had a lot of climbing adventures, and I'm not sure I can go across the Traverse of the Gods and up the White Spider anymore. I'm done with that chapter. So, we've had a lot of that. So, yeah, we're looking for, you know, just maybe different ways of writing about that story.
Yeah.
Different one to say. I mean, the mistakes are, to whom it may concern, just unsorted chapters, just dumped on our in tray.
Yeah.
You know, we like to, you know, and we are commercial, you know, we like to hear about what you're going to do to promote the book.
Yeah.
And not tell us all your mates think it's brilliant.
Yeah. I think that's the thing that most people don't understand, is you need to almost promote in place already to promote your own book, don't you? The days of, you know, where Random House would take this unknown and, you know, everyone would buy the book. Those days have gone, really, haven't they?
Yeah, the sales aren't there. I mean, the other thing we get quite a lot of, we get come June, July, we get quite a lot of I Climbed Everest a month ago submissions.
Right.
We get two or three of them every summer.
Yeah.
So they get back from their trip.
It's like an annual, like a
yeah, yeah, we should, yeah, we should do, you know, so we've done three already now this year. So we get quite a lot of those that they're a waste of time. And then we get, you know, and then we get people that, you know, walk to the base camp of Everest. We, you know, we get maybe five Everest submissions a year at least.
Yeah.
So I guess the stuff I like is people that, you know, I'm not saying you have to go read Tillman, but people that have sort of read something like Tillman and can write something a bit like that, but different.
Yeah.
I quite like those. And
like an interesting story well told. Often there's one of those bits is missing, I guess.
Yeah. And people are brutally honest. I mean, if you've got an angle, you know, if you've got something to say,
yeah,
you know, that's not controversial, but honest, you know,
yeah.
I quite like that. As we know, I like your writing, you know, yours is, you know, that's that kind of stuff. If, you know, so if anybody, you know, my favorite book is Unknown Pleasures, because you don't need a long,
read on the toilet.
Really short chapters. Yeah. There's lots of them, and you can just take it or leave it. I kind of like that kind of stuff. Anybody that can write like that.
Yeah, because time is so precious these days, isn't it?
Yeah.
To sit and get to the end of a whole book. Mm. I know it's on Kindle. I seem to have like five or six books all going at the same time on Kindle.
Yeah. I think, and we're trying to do a little bit about wildlife and, you know, put a bit of that into some books.
Yeah, because you're trying to help with the getting rid of all the shooting birds
kind of
kind of thing. Do you get any sort of pushback with that, or is that just a positive?
No, not really. But I don't think we'd be noticed.
Yeah,
a tiny bit, but I don't think we'd be noticed. I think we're way off the radar.
Yeah, I think there's basically these like three. You know, you have like third wave feminism. I think there's kind of first, second, third environmentalism.
Yeah.
And I think it was like David Icke was saying that when Prince Charles was talking about organic food, you know, and this kind of stuff, people thought he was crazy, and everyone made jokes about him, like talking to the plants. And Greenpeace was this, you know, totally radical thing where, you know, 20 years later, it's like mainstream kind of stuff. So I guess a lot of these things that seem like not very important, like about the uplands and rewilding and all this kind of stuff, I guess in 10 years they'll probably be front and centre, won't they, really?
We've got an author, John Burns, and he writes a bit of comedy, and he's writing about raptor persecution and rewilding in Scotland in his latest book, Skydance. But we've sent him out to write a new book it's going to be called Wild Winter. It won't be out for 18 months or so. And we're sending him out looking for wildlife, and he's sending draft chapters in. And I was shocked to learn, he's going looking for mountain hares. I was shocked to learn that the population in mountain hares is 1% of what it was 20, 30 years ago.
Mm, right.
And all those
eagles have killed them all.
It's the eagles. It's definitely the eagles. That's what the landowner said. And just that level of nonsensical persecution.
Yeah.
You know, I've always found. I mean, when I was a kid, I was brought up in a hunting and shooting community, and from a very early age, I found it abhorrent. And all my mates. I mean, I had a shotgun. We all had shotguns. We'd all go shooting. And I found it very abhorrent, you know, from a very early age, and watching what was happening to the landscape, you know, as the farming got more intensive, and watching that just no regard for wildlife from the shooting community and the hunting community.
Yeah.
Awful, awful crimes being committed. And, you know, I think as we get a bit maturer as a publisher, you know, it'd be good to publish in that area.
Yeah, yeah. I think. Well, I guess that's a good.
Because I'm sick of going across the traverse of the gods with a brace of partridge.
I guess it's interesting, though, isn't it? How you can. I guess it's like you're an adventure publisher, but it's an adventure publishing as well, because you're moving it along. You're moving the literature along.
Yeah.
And the people maybe, I wonder if people will start trusting that it's a you know, Vertebra book rather than just who's on the author, you know, just who the author is. Like, oh, this is by Vertebra, this must be a good book.
We have I'm conscious that people are getting bored of hearing me talk. We have, when we're commissioning a book or when we're doing a book, we have a number of people on our website, and they come and buy every single book published without fail. And we have it in our head during the commissioning process, you know, that, you know, is that the sort of book Hannah will buy?
That one, the 1%,
yeah,
we're gonna,
yeah, yeah, you know, and if it isn't, we probably wouldn't do it.
Yeah,
you know, we, you know, so we definitely, you know, there's probably 10 people. There's a, you know, a guy, Nigel, there's Hannah, there's a, you know, there's a Keith, and we know the names, you know. And we just think about that, and we, you know, we have that responsibility. And I guess, yeah, it's what you're saying about that connection between famous climbers and not famous climbers and all the rest of it. You know, we are, it is a small community, and we are all friends.
Yeah.
And it is nice that, you know, they'll help you out.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, yeah. You know, whether it's, you know, we got some support off the BMC to help with some publication stuff this year, and, you know, and I think, you know, Jerry Moffitt was in the other day helping with some stuff.
Yeah.
You know, we'll get photos sent over all the time.
Yeah, it's a small village.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'd like to finish by just telling the story how you went from having a graphic design side of Vertebra and the publishing side. When you told me the story about your one of your mentors who gave you this advice.
Oh God, yeah. So yeah. So we had, We were graphic design, web design, and we were publishing books. And, you know, we made, all of our money was made from websites, and our turnover was everything from websites. And we were based on Salt Lake. And I had a mentor, very, very experienced guy, an entrepreneur, used to work in management teams. And I was like, look, you've got to give up the websites and just focus on publishing. That's what you're good at. And he was saying, look, you're arguably the world's best publisher of mountaineering books, and you've just got to focus on that. And I was like, yeah, but all our turnover is on, you know, we make all of our money on websites. He says, yeah, yeah, yeah. He says, look, you're arguably the world's best publisher of mountaineering books. He says, you're probably the third best website producer on Salter Lane. and it was so we just took the leap, and we just stopped doing websites and graphic design, and we just concentrated on publishing. And he was absolutely right, because there was people, you don't think, because you're so close to it, there's people as passionate as producing websites as we were to produce mountaineering literature.
Yeah.
So we just left them to do websites because they love it, and I hated it.
Yeah.
And now we just, you know, publish books, and it, you know, it's better and successful.
Yeah. Well, thanks from all the outdoor readers out there for putting the effort. So.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today, we talk brainstorms with UX designer Brian. Let's go. First question. You thought you'd see everyone's idea in the team brainstorm, but you've got a grand total of one. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board, right? Because in Miro, the team can add ideas now or later. And with Privacy Mode, we can keep them anonymous until they're good to share.
Correct. Next, you need the best way to explain your idea, but all you have is a few sticky notes. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board, because, you know, in Miro, I could record videos, add text, images, links, and digital sticky notes, of course. Present my thoughts the way I want.
Right again! Now, you're looking for a past idea you thought was just genius. Only you could find... Oh, there it is! Drawing Board or...
Miro! All our finished and unfinished work lives in one place.
And he's won.
Join over 60 million people getting ideas noticed in Miro Brainstorms. Get your first three boards for free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.